Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of the Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, a living laboratory for accelerating social change. It is my privilege to host this podcast, where we talk with change leaders from around the world about this sector's potential for creating a world where all beings live well individually and collectively. I'm so pleased to welcome as my guest today a man who's been evaluating social change efforts for four decades, Michael Quinn Patton. Michael's leadership in the field of evaluation is renowned, including several prestigious awards for his work in moving the whole field of evaluation forward. Michael has written five books on both the science and the art of program evaluation. His most recent book, Developmental Evaluation, focuses on evaluating success in the uncertain environment of complex and changing systems. Perhaps his best-known book, though, is one he co-authored with Francis Wesley and Brenda Zimmerman, Getting to Maybe, where that team did what evaluators do. They looked at real-life examples of social change to determine, much like this podcast asks, what factors lead to change. Given that his whole life has been spent exploring the questions at the core of this podcast, it's my pleasure to have Michael Patton share his observations with us today here on Making Change. My guest today on Making Change is Michael Quinn Patton. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Me too. I love having evaluators on the program because the job of an evaluator is really the exact topic of this podcast, which is change happening? And if so, what's creating it? So I will just ask you that question flat out. When you see things that really are changing, when you see change really happening, what do you see undergirding that change?
It's a great question, and it's important that you're addressing it with so many different perspectives because it's not a singular thing. And that's really where, as an evaluator, we begin, is to divide up the world into different kinds of changes and different kinds of actions where the criteria for what constitutes effectiveness are quite different. So, for example, one kind of important change that is less valued than I think it ought to be are the people in the trenches who are providing very, very badly needed services day in and day out without a lot of glamour, soup kitchens, feeding the hungry, providing clothing. One of the examples that I have featured as a case study is the Damiano Center in Duluth, which began as a soup kitchen in the farm crisis in the 1980s as a temporary help and is still going strong, feeding thousands of people and providing clothing and some community services. A program that actually was inspired by, in its current iteration, by Robert Eggers, DC Kitchens, who you interviewed. Mm-hmm. Of course, they had to adapt their program to Duluth because they don't have a lot of full-time chefs who can come in and do things in Duluth.
It's not like DC.
It's not DC. But Robert, one of his influences was helping to inspire this kitchen in Duluth in the Central Health side, a poor area of Duluth. And so those folks are making change by providing ongoing services. They have to be accountable in a very direct, measurable way for the numbers of people that they serve and the quite concrete outcomes that they achieve. They don't get as much attention as with all the manic attention these days on innovation and big time change. But without those solid grassroots people who are carrying on day in and day out, delivering needed services, homeless shelters, serving people with AIDS, a lot of important things wouldn't happen. One form of making change then is keeping things from getting worse, is keeping people from sliding into a deeper and deeper difficulty. So the criteria for evaluating those kinds of activities are quite different from the criteria for innovative programs that are trying to do things differently or big systems change initiatives. One of the things, an exercise I sometimes do with boards in foundations in helping them think about evaluation as a many splintered and diverse thing, since most of them are fairly sophisticated about financial instruments, I do an exercise where I have them compare different kinds of programmatic initiatives and change efforts to different kinds of financial instruments, because they know that different kinds of financial instruments, blue chip bonds, venture capital, small cap stocks, value stocks, long-term bonds, short-term bonds, are evaluated by different criteria.
Sure.
And so I'll have them look at a portfolio and say, so what are your blue chips? What's your small caps here? What's your venture cap stocks here? What's your long-term bonds? And they get it that you can't evaluate everything the same.
Right.
That in fact, those are different niches and they require different evaluation criteria. And one of the difficulties we face evaluatively is that people don't bring that sort of simple sophistication to evaluation, think that one size fits all, that it's a single thing and that you do the same thing for all kinds of initiatives. So evaluation as a field has become a many splintered thing with many different approaches. In my utilization-focused evaluation textbook, I identify over 100 different kinds of evaluation.
Wow.
So like anything, there's a menu of things. I get calls from people. I'll answer the phone and they say, are you the patent who does evaluation? And I say, that's the rumor. And they say, well, we need one. And I say, well, what kind do you need? And there's a long silence. And then they say, a kind? And I say, yeah, if you're going to go to a restaurant, you have to pick a kind. If you're going to buy a computer, you have to pick a kind. If you're going to buy a car, you have to pick a kind. What kind of evaluation do you need? And they say, well, we got this 3-year foundation grant and it's coming to an end and we just noticed we're supposed to do an evaluation. And I say, I don't do that kind. So that's part of what's important, I think, about your work in making change is identifying that change itself is a many splendored thing. And that's why evaluation has to be diverse and multifaceted, is evaluation has to match the nature and type of change that's being undertaken.
Over the years that you have been doing this work, I am sure that you have seen an entire spectrum from the keeping things from getting worse end of the spectrum to actually really seeing systems change and community change that's visible and palpable, sort of from the lack of a negative to really the creation of something positive. When you see that more aggressive end of the spectrum, the systems change end of the spectrum, which many of our listeners are really very anxious to know more about, what causes that? What do you see happening when you're seeing bigger changes like that, those system types of changes?
Well, interestingly, what we found in the book that I did with two Canadian co-authors called Getting to Maybe How the World Has Changed with Francis Wesley and Brenda Zimmerman, and we looked at case studies of major change. And when we went into doing that book, we were determined not to find that a major answer to making major change was leadership. And Jim Collins and his team, you may recall the story in his methodology section when they did Good to Great. Jim Collins told his team when they did case studies of great companies, now we're going to go out and we're going to study the factors that make great companies, but there are 1,000 books on leadership. Leadership is not going to be one of our factors. And the team came back to him after doing the initial case studies and the initial analysis and said, Jim, we've found several factors, and one of them is leadership. And he said, go back and reanalyze the data and look at it some other way. Well, we went through that same process. And what I find over and over again is that people make a difference. It's what we actually call the personal factor. And the way that I originally came at this was studying evaluation use. My professional career of 40 years as an evaluator has been centered on finding ways to increase the use of evaluation. And we have done a lot of studying of factors related to using evaluation to make change and to support change and to adapt change. And I come out of a sociological background where individual people are not supposed to make a difference. Mm-hmm. It's all about systems and positions and organizational structures. But what we found and still find over and over again is that the personal factor makes a difference. The dedication, the commitment, the knowledge of people working individually and together, providing leadership, figuring out how to get through the rough patches, raising money, overcoming adversity, while the world is in the search for transportable recipes and things that they can take to scale, the reason that never works is because you can't clone those leaders. And so a program that's highly effective one place, and it turns out that a lot of it has to do with extraordinary people making extraordinary effort, you can abstract that out into a model and set it down somewhere else, and it doesn't work the same way, because ultimately those things depend upon a highly effective and dedicated people. And it's the reason that one of the major findings of evaluation over the last 40 years has been the deteriorating effectiveness of programs over several generations of replication. Programs that in their pilot phase can be demonstrated to be highly effective, and then the next generation is somewhat less effective, and the next generation is somewhat less effective. Is that people doing pilot programs, experimenting, trying to make major change, are different than people implementing on a routine basis. And their motivations are different, and their effectiveness is different.
So when you talk about the deterioration over time, are you talking about the same program in the same place, or are you talking about replication of that program?
Both. The same program in the same place. Once you start getting staff turnover mm-hmm. and different people coming in, it turns out to be very difficult to maintain the levels of effectiveness that tend to be originally demonstrated at the pilot level.
So what is one to do then to keep that effectiveness up?
That's one of the great questions, and I think that's part of the reason why a major focus in leadership development and organizational development, and now in evaluation, is ongoing capacity building, is reinvigorating organizations by realizing that capacity wanes and that conditions change. So that a second factor, you ask about factors mm-hmm. of effectiveness. The first I've pointed to is the personal factor, sometimes called leadership, but it's individuals making a difference individually and collectively. But a second major factor is that those individuals, I find, the ones that I encounter who make a big difference, and every chapter of my developmental evaluation book begins with a story of such people, as does every chapter, as you know, in the Getting to Maybe book begins with a right. chapter of a major change, is that what those change makers have in common is a hunger for knowledge to get better, is a willingness and an openness to take in data, to do environmental scanning, to pay attention to what's working and what's not working, to be attuned to how the environment is changing, how the context is developing. And so these don't tend to be people who are rigidly implementing a singular idea come hell or high water, they're going right. to do their thing. They're people who are paying attention, who are adapting, who are willing to change, who are willing to acknowledge that their good idea wasn't working in practice and to do something different. And they are able to do that because they don't confuse making change with supporting their ego needs. That in fact, what they really care about is making change. And so they're hungry to know what works. The great partnerships I can form as an evaluator are with people who are hungry for information. I've found that evaluation is not something people come to very willingly. We like to say that evaluation is one of those words like biopsy and subpoena that most people would just as soon not have in their lives. And so the folks for whom evaluation really works and who make evaluation part of the change process are people who are open, who are hungry for information, who realize they don't have it all figured out, that they need to be able to adapt. They need to know what's working and not working. They're hungry for that information. And that's not a typical case.
It's interesting as you're talking, I'm getting this sense that it is the difference between being attached to the means. I have a good idea of how to do something. And it's sometimes ego, but it's sometimes just that attachment to the idea, the enthrallment with the idea of this is how, versus really holding oneself accountable for the results. I have an image in my mind of what I want it to look like when I'm done, and it's not there yet. And I'm going to learn everything I can and find everything I can, because that's really what I'm holding myself accountable for. I'm really getting that sense of the difference between means and ends here.
I'm glad you brought up that theme, because holding oneself accountable is the first of the Pollyanna principles. And as you talk about it with the sophistication that you bring to it, I think that that is an important factor. Unfortunately, from my experience, the word accountability has become virtually meaningless and actually does harm in the way it's getting used in our current environment. It's something that everybody talks about. Every politician is in favor of accountability for everybody except themselves. And that it's actually indeed part of my concern about the very framing of the Pollyanna first principle, we accomplish what we hold ourselves accountable for, is that there's a kind of mechanistic notion there that you set goals and then do whatever it takes to attain those. There's a lot of harm that gets done under that kind of rubric that treats the outcomes focus as a kind of sufficient thing. It's basically what was behind No Child Left Behind, was we're going to set standards and hold people accountable for them. And it's been a disaster. Pay for performance is routinely a disaster. The performance measurement mantra that what gets measured gets done has its shadow side that if you measure the wrong things, you do the wrong things. And Campbell's Law, named for the great social innovator and evaluator Donald Campbell, states that when any indicator becomes a high-stakes indicator, it will be corrupted. And that is the history of a lot of performance measurement, is that a singular attention to accountability as an end in itself actually distorts things. Accountability works in a space where we know what to do, where there's a solid knowledge base, where we know the kind of things that in fact ought to be done to produce desired outcomes. But in complex dynamic systems where we don't exercise control, a basic principle of good accountability is you can only be accountable for what you can control.
Right.
In complex dynamic systems, we don't have much control. And so accountability actually interferes with accomplishment. One of the things I write about in developmental evaluation is work on strategy by the great strategy scholar Henry Mintzberg, who did a book called Tracking Strategies, mm-hmm. in which he looks at highly effective, high-performing businesses, nonprofits, government units. And what he finds is that they all start out with some kind of intention of what they want to accomplish, and they implement some of that and pursue those outcomes. But this is where it gets interesting. The high-performing organizations that are paying attention to what is going on in the world find that some of what they wanted to accomplish actually didn't make much sense once they started doing the work and testing their assumptions. And so they left some things behind and were able to change their outcomes. At the same time, because they were paying attention to things that were emerging and new opportunities, new things emerged that they picked up. Opportunities that they hadn't even conceptualized and outcomes they didn't know were important until they began the work. What we find in tracking strategy over a period of time with high-performing organizations is that they start out with intentions, accomplish some of what they intend, leave some of what they intended behind, pick up some new things that they hadn't expected to encounter, and that where they end up over a 3 to 5 year period is a combination of what they intended, what they left behind because it wasn't working and didn't make sense, mm-hmm. and the new things they learned along the way. Traditional accountability-focused evaluation interferes with that kind of adaptiveness because it holds people accountable only for accomplishing exactly what they could foresee 3 to 5 years ahead of time, right. and what they were presumably funded to do. And that narrow form of accountability is a barrier to innovation and adaptation.
I think one of the things that's coming up for me as you're talking about it is exactly how you introduced the topic of accountability, which is that there are probably as many definitions of that as there are of evaluation. The thought that is occurring to me is that there are the things for which we hold ourselves accountable, and there are the things for which we are measuring up to somebody else's standard of accountability. And when we talk about No Child Left Behind, that was somebody else's accountability standard that was being imposed on, as frequently is with funding. Here's my level of outcome that I want you to achieve. I'll give you money to achieve that. Here's the thing that you will now hold yourself accountable for. Versus when we really are holding ourselves accountable, I think there's a different, I think that's in part what happens when folks are, as you mentioned, hungry for knowledge and eager to adapt and eager, as you quote Mintzberg, and I'm a Mintzberg fan, I'm always happy to hear somebody quoting him. When we're holding ourselves accountable, we're also sort of looking at what emerges, holding that intention and letting that evolve. I think it's a real big difference when we're holding ourselves accountable for something, not being attached to how we do it, but saying, here's what I'd like life to be like for people, versus somebody else saying, if you want the dollars, we're holding you accountable.
Yeah, and I appreciate those differentiations. And in fact, I treat accountability when I'm working with folks as a sensitizing concept that needs to be defined as what it means for people, what will make it meaningful in context. Even at the individual level where people hold themselves accountable, they can do so in ways that are mechanical and rigid. Right. In the Getting to Maybe book, we tell the story of General Romeo Dallaire, who was the United Nations Lieutenant General, Canadian Lieutenant General in charge of the United Nations peacekeeping forces in Rwanda. He held himself accountable for stopping the genocide, and he had a nervous breakdown as a result. One of the things that I see a lot, actually, in the nonprofit sector is, you know, among leaders, is people holding themselves too accountable for things over which they don't have control. And it leads to some serious mental health problems because they take on more than they can be responsible for. They're the kind of people who tend to do that, and they aren't able to develop a very broad perspective about accountability. Even at the individual level, we find lots of instances where people set unrealistic outcomes for themselves and make themselves crazy trying to meet those without being able to be adaptable. So the kind of accountabilities that I find myself working with in people making change is not just accountability to achieve predetermined outcomes, their own or somebody else's, but accountability for learning, accountability for adaptability, accountability for resilience, accountability to monitor what's working and not working and adjust accordingly. Those are not the traditional meanings of accountability, but that's the kind of accountability that really supports making change.
That's brilliant. Can you share a story where you have seen the factors that you're talking about at play, that hunger for knowledge and the individuals making a difference? Can you share a story that you've seen where it has created something pretty significant?
Well, one of the examples in the developmental evaluation book is the story of Steve Rothschild, who was the vice president at General Mills, who brought Yoplait yogurt to the United States and was appropriately well rewarded for that success and retired and decided to dedicate himself to fighting poverty. And he wanted to bring the things that he had learned in the corporate world into the nonprofit world. One of those, of whom there are a great many these days, business leaders who think that all the nonprofit world needs is all the great things that businesses are doing so well.
Exactly.
I'm always amazed that folks actually look at the business world and think there are things that we ought to be adopting in the nonprofit world from all the disasters out there in the business world, including performance measurement, which is more corrupt there even than it is in the nonprofit world. But Steve was one of these people who was hungry for knowledge, and partly because he realized he was coming into a new sector. He set up a employment training program for chronically unemployed men of color. And what Steve wanted to do was give them all the benefits of the corporate world, one of which was very sophisticated human resource assessment tools. So they recruited a group of chronically unemployed men of color and began putting them through a battery of tests that were used at General Mills, personality tests, achievement tests, reading tests, intelligence tests, diagnostic tests, some 360 things. Mm-hmm. And within 2 days, 80% of the people dropped out. And we did follow-up interviews with those folks and found that, first, the whole process scared them to death. Mm-hmm. Secondly, they had had nothing but bad experiences with tests and diagnostic experiences in their lives. And in fact, what they were looking for and hungry for and what they would trust was a relationship with somebody, not some instrument. Mm-hmm. And that they had very negative responses. To Steve's benefit, he was able to hear that. Throughout all the instrumentation, his whole plan for all of the work they were going to do, diagnosing people and then coaching them against the data, and reconfigured the program into a probationary period where it was really like a dating period where the people in the program would get to know the participants. The participants would get to know the staff, and they would decide how they could work together and form a relationship before they decided what kind of changes they were going to make. And Steve has actually just come out with a book called The Non-Nonprofit that is about the principles they've discovered, one of which is the importance of accountability in holding participants accountable for the things that they commit themselves to. But he was an example of somebody really willing to learn and to change what they were doing. And that's continued to be true of that program all the way along, is as the things that they thought were going to work didn't work. He's been very hungry for feedback, and they've made continuous and ongoing changes all the way along.
It's brilliant. And it really is that adaptability, that willingness to learn. That it's not even a willingness. You're right. It is really a hunger.
And a good example on a larger scale, because I know from many of the interviews you do that you're interested in large scale systems change and big picture change. And there's almost nothing bigger in that regard than the worldwide campaign to eradicate polio. Mm-hmm. The Gates Foundation and the World Health Organization have put over $3 billion into the eradication of polio. And about 18 months ago, they were both preparing the worldwide celebration for the second time in human history where we've eradicated a disease, the first time being smallpox. On the verge of that celebration, where polio was down to three countries in the world, it's broken out into 19 new countries. It's pandemic again in Africa. It's broken out in Tajikistan for the first time in 30 years. And it turns out that one of the contributing factors was the narrow vertical strategy of focusing single-mindedly on that goal of eradicating polio and ignoring what else was going on. They actually weakened healthcare systems in Africa by attracting the best and the brightest from the healthcare into the polio campaign and doing harm to general healthcare, ignoring the food crisis in parts of Africa. It turns out that when people are not in good health and starving and with the complications of HIV/AIDS, you can't just focus on polio and ignore everything else. And so, again, to Bill Gates' credit and the WHO, as they went and looked at what went wrong with their strategy, they've determined that a vertical strategy, a single-minded vertical strategy, ignoring everything else, picking a goal and going after it with huge resources and ignoring the surrounding systems and interdependent with other parts of change, does harm. Right. And that what they've now have to go to is a more horizontal strategy of looking at supporting the entire health system, of dealing with supporting systems outside of health if they're really going to accomplish this goal of eradicating polio. So some of the things that we think are good ideas and we've inherited, and one of them is this narrow focus upon a single outcome and a vertical strategy, can have unanticipated negative consequences.
It sounds like in both of these examples and in others that you've given, that maybe one of your third factors might be that whole integration of various factors.
I couldn't say it better. That's precisely the additional factor, is the capacity to take a systems perspective, to look at interdependencies, to look at multiple things operating at the same time, to move away from a narrow version of attribution and move into what we currently are talking about as contribution analysis, which does in fact look at interconnectedness, interdependent kinds of factors. And it's a very different way of understanding change, but I think it's a more effective one over the long term.
Well, Michael, I am so appreciative of your time. I could talk to you for another hour and a half here if we had the time, and maybe one of these days we can do that. I just really, really appreciate your sharing your wisdom and your experience with our listeners.
Delighted to do so, and appreciate the contributions you're making to making change through your interviews and your other work.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Speaking with Michael, I'm struck by the ongoing back and forth that social change agents face as we move between the desire for things to be simple and linear and the reality that life on this planet is indeed a complex web of, well, everything. We want programs to be easily replicable, transferable from scenario to scenario, only to find that it's not that easy. We want to make and implement clear-cut plans, only to find that things are not always what we thought they were. We want to solve narrowly focused problems, only to find those problems are intertwined with circumstances and conditions far beyond our narrow scope. The key to success, as Michael shares, is therefore not a checklist of things to do, but a way of thinking, reaching for what is possible in broad rather than narrow terms, and then embracing complexity and staying open to learning. Learning from what other people have done is one thing, but as Michael shows us, learning from how successful change agents think is immensely more powerful. One of the most striking observations Michael made is about the issue of accountability. I love the story he told at the very beginning of the interview, where he told a prospective client, "I don't do evaluations just to fulfill a funder requirement." There's a huge difference in what we can accomplish when we're holding ourselves accountable and aligning our resources behind that end result, versus when we're trying to live up to someone else's definition of accountability, usually based on the fact that they're footing the bill. Which leads to questions for your own work. How are you defining the results you intend to create in your community? If your work were 100% successful, what would your community look like? And most importantly, what might indicators be that could tell you if you're succeeding? Considering the issue of complexity, how many times throughout a week or a month do you hear people at your organization saying, "But that's not our mission"? If you're working at a food bank, the topic might be education or workforce development. It might be mental health or all the other interwoven issues that, like Michael's example of eradicating polio, will make or break the success of your food bank's ultimate mission. If those issues come up often in your conversations, what small steps might you take to include that wider web of organizations in those conversations, folks who can work together to explore more complex approaches to those complex issues? And finally, there's the issue of being open to learning and changing course. What mechanisms do you have for taking time to reflect, to step back and ask some of the most important questions any group can ask? Do we have all the information we need? What do we need to know about this topic that we don't already know? How can we be sure that we aren't missing something? Who can we involve? Who can help us to continue to learn and grow, to have the best chance of accomplishing the results we want? As you begin exploring these big questions, I hope you'll share your observations at the Chronicle's website, philanthropy.com, and at Creating the Future's Facebook page at facebook.com/creatingthefuture. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me through our website at creatingthefuture.org or on Twitter at Hilde Gottlieb. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a healthy, vibrant future for your community and our world. For the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hilde Gottlieb. We'll see you the second Thursday of next month here on Making Change.